Sorry. Hello.
Thank you for standing by and welcome to the ISDA CDS Hardwiring Update Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. There'll be a presentation followed by a question and answer session, at which time if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. I must advise you the conference is being recorded today, Tuesday the 3rd of March 2009. I would now like to hand the conference over to your first speaker today, David Geen. Please go ahead and thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. This is David Geen from ISDA. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our call to discuss the latest drafts of the CDS auction supplements and protocol. I'm joined by my ISDA colleagues, Mark New and Kirsty Davenport and others, and by David Lucking, John Williams, and Shruti Ajitaria from Allen & Overy, our counsel. And also by Tom Benison from JP Morgan, Thanasis Diplas from Deutsche Bank, and Todd Sullivan from Morgan Stanley, who have been working on this project with us and who can help us in dealing with your questions. The format for today's call is that in a few minutes I will hand over to David Lucking from Allen & Overy to go through the presentation, which has a summary of the key provisions of the documentation, and then we will open up for your questions at the end. We have received some questions in advance from some of you. We will try to cover them during the course of the presentation or afterwards. We will, if necessary, hold further calls during the adherence period and possibly before, if necessary, so this isn't the last chance that people will have to hear about these documents, but we hope that today's call will help you in your review of the new documentation. We have now made available the latest drafts dated today, the 3rd of March, of all the documentation. They're available on our website at www.ISDA.org, along with a copy of the slides that are going to be used today. And we will, throughout this process now, keep the latest draft of the documents available on the website for you to download, and when we circulate new drafts, we'll include black lines of the drafts against the drafts you've already seen. As a reminder of the timeline before we get to the presentation itself, the new timeline for this project is that we will publish the supplement and the protocol next Thursday, the 12th of March, and they will be open for the protocol will be open for adherence until the 7th of April. That's the last day of adherence. The changes set out in the protocol will take effect on the 8th of April, and the fixed coupon market practice change will also take effect in North America on the 8th of April. In order for us to meet this timetable, which although extended from the previous timetable is still tight, we will need final comments on the documentation by this Friday, by noon New York time, this Friday, the 6th of March, and we appreciate your understanding of the tight timelines, and we thank those who have already provided comments on previous drafts of these documents. So what I'd like to do now is turn over to David Lucking, who will walk us through at a fairly high level the presentation that's available on the website, and after that we will open the lines for questions. David?
Thanks very much, David. Okay, so I'm going to walk through the slides, and hopefully you have those in front of you. The agenda for the presentation really is to explain the different elements of the documentation that are going to implement these changes to the various CDS products. Initially, I will begin by talking about the supplement itself, which is a supplement to the 2003 credit derivatives definitions and makes certain amendments to the definitions, and can be incorporated into parties' new credit derivative transactions. That supplement contains two annexes and achieves three main aims. The aims of the supplement are to introduce an ISDA credit derivatives determinations committee, or a number of committees organized via region. And the supplement contains an annex that actually sets out how those committees are composed and the mandate of the committee and the decisions that those committees will take. The second aim of the supplement is to hardwire into the CDS product a new auction settlement method, so a third settlement method to credit derivative transactions that we anticipate will become the standard settlement method for CDS trades. And the supplement contains an annex that sets out the auction methodology which will be followed each time a credit event occurs to arrive at an auction final price. And that auction methodology is based very closely on the auction methodology that you will be familiar with from the recent CDS protocols that have been published in respect of credit events that have occurred over the past couple of years. The final thing that the supplement seeks to achieve is an amendment to the convention for purposes of being able to trigger credit events, and also the convention that applies for succession events to have application to credit derivative transactions. And creates a new concept of credit event backstop dates and succession event backstop dates. For those of you that have been following the project, you'll have heard us talk previously about the 60-day and 90-day look back with respect to credit events and succession events. And those backstop dates really act a little bit like a statute of limitation on events that occur, so that if events occur more than 60 to 90 days from the date that the committee is asked to consider whether or not an event constitutes a credit event or succession event, then those events actually become stale for purposes of your transactions and are no longer triggerable. But I'll go into some more detail about how that works towards the end of the slide. So those three components are really implemented via the supplement, and as I said, the supplement is incorporated into transactions that are entered into after the supplement is published. But in order to bring existing credit derivative transactions in line with this new regime and to ensure that a book of credit derivative transactions that already exist at the time the supplement is published that there isn't any basis risk essentially between the new regime and existing transactions, ISDA is publishing a protocol which we call the Big Bang Protocol that will actually implement the changes in the supplement for purposes of existing transactions that parties already have on their books. And then, as David mentioned at the end of the presentation, we will reserve some time for questions and hopefully address any questions that people have. One thing that I would stress is that there are also some additional changes that people have probably heard about that may be implemented in certain geographical locations. But to the extent that I don't mention those in the presentation, then you can consider that those are not changes to the CDS product that are going to be implemented either via the supplement or the protocol, but that those are trading conventions that will apply on a going forward basis outside of the supplement and the protocol. And we will also be happy to answer questions on those changes, but I just want to make sure that people don't get confused by thinking that those are actually included in the new supplemental protocol. So turning to the supplement, first of all, as I said, this is a supplement to the 2003 credit derivatives definitions, and it has three aims. The first is to establish the determinations committees. The second is to add the auction settlement method as a third settlement method in the credit derivatives definitions. And finally, it achieves the changes to the definitions that are necessary in order to implement the 60-day, 90-day look-back concepts. There are two annexes to the supplement, a set of very extensive rules that have been the subject of a lot of negotiation, and I'll be going into some detail about how the details of those rules. Those rules are obviously being published in order to promote the transparency of the process and the transparency of the determinations that the committee makes. Similarly, there is a second annex, which is the form of auction settlement terms, that is also published so that people can see how it is intended that any auction that will be held in respect of a credit event would be organized and operate. That set of auction settlement terms is, though, simply a template, and it is anticipated that each time that an actual credit event occurs, there would be a set of auction settlement terms that will be published based very closely on those auction settlement terms, but the committee will need to make certain determinations with respect to the individual relevant issues relating to the auction that is held, such as dates, timings, etc. And so that is why those auction settlement terms would be published for each individual credit event that occurs. The supplement is anticipated to be incorporated for all future transactions and that it will become the trading standard going forward. And the supplement is designed to work for all geographical regions. So the intention is that this standard will become a global standard for all corporate and sovereign reference entity transaction types that exist in the ISDA matrix at the moment. The one thing that the supplement doesn't contemplate is application of these provisions currently to the US muni transaction types in the matrix. Turning to how the committee is constituted and what the purpose of the different determinations committees is, these committees really are necessary in order to achieve the hardwiring of the AUC into parties' contracts, because as I mentioned, each time an auction is held, it is necessary for certain decisions to be made in order for those auctions to function properly. And so as part of the process of hardwiring the auction settlement method into people's transactions, we needed to come up with a transparent and binding method for those determinations to be made. A committee is essentially composed of a cross-section of the credit derivatives market. So there are both dealer and non-dealer members on the committee, and there are also both voting members and non-voting observing members who will essentially act as alternates in circumstances where the voting members of the committee are removed from the committee for either non-participation in or non-performance of their obligations in relation to the committee. We expect that participation on the committee is going to be a relatively involved process, you can imagine that if these committees had existed over the past 6 months, there would have been very regular meetings. And so in order to participate in the committee, people need to be prepared for a relatively high level of involvement. The committees are structured, as I said, as a cross-section of both dealers and non-dealers. There are 10 dealer voting members on the committee and 5 non-dealer members on the committee. And among the dealer members, the committee is broken down into 8 global dealers who will serve on every committee that gets constituted. And then there will be 2 regional dealers. And the reason why I've been talking about committees in the plural is because ISDA will constitute a committee each time that a question comes to ISDA on the basis of the appropriate geographical location for that committee to be organized. So, for example, if the question that ISDA is asked pertains to a credit event with respect to a North American corporate entity, then ISDA would compose the Americas region committee, which would be made up of the 8 global dealers, the 5 non-dealers, and 2 regional dealers who would be selected from dealers who have who make a large market in North American corporate reference entities. The criteria for participation on the committee are set out in the rules so that it is transparent, and the criteria for participation on the committee as a dealer is going to be based upon DTCC trading volume over the previous 12-month period. Each committee gets composed essentially for a 12-month period. ISDA will be acting as the secretary of the committee, and so ISDA would be the first point of contact for anyone seeking to have a question that would be resolved by the committee. And so there are, as I mentioned, criteria set out in the rules pertaining to how an institution may become either a dealer or a non-dealer member of the committee. Essentially, in order to be a dealer member, the institution has to have shown a commitment to the credit derivatives market as a whole. And one way that we achieve that is by ensuring that those dealers have participated as participating bidders in credit event auctions that have been held during the last 12 months. All members of the committee will be required to have adhered to the Big Bang Protocol so that they have not only agreed to implement the supplement on a going-forwards basis, but they've also bought their book of business in line with this new regime. And as I mentioned, DTCC will be compiling notional trade volume data, and essentially the members of the committee will be composed of the largest dealers based on that notional trade volume. The non-dealer criteria is slightly different, and the reason for that is because ISDA actually created a separate working group of non-dealer members of ISDA who were involved in comprehensive consultation, and they came up with their own selection criteria. The way that the non-dealer criteria works is that there will be a large pool of non-dealer institutions, essentially institutions that have at least $1 billion of assets under management and that have a notional single name CDS trade exposure of at least $1 billion. And from that large pool of non-dealer institutions, the 5 non-dealer members of the committee will be selected at random and will serve for staggered one-year terms in order to permit as wide a cross-section as possible of the non-dealer community to participate on the committee over the coming years. Now, the committee has a mandate to consider a relatively broad range of questions that are important to the credit derivative market as a whole. The purpose of the committee is to try and remove some of the ambiguities that may exist in circumstances where events occur that would affect the credit derivative market, and those determinations of the committee will actually be binding upon any contracting parties that have either incorporated the supplement into their transaction or have amended their transactions by operation of the Big Bang Protocol. So it's important for any market participant to feel comfortable with the way that the committee works, and so we give any market participant the ability to approach ISDA to request that the committee consider a particular issue. Now, the committee has sometimes been referred to as a kind of dispute resolution mechanism, but what I would like to just kind of clarify is that the committee is not set up to resolve individual disputes with respect to people's contracts, but rather the committee is there to serve the market as a whole and to achieve a resolution of ambiguous issues that will have impact for a large number of market participants. But a market participant will approach ISDA to request that ISDA convene a committee within the relevant region. And to the extent that the members of the relevant committee, a single member of that committee supports that question, that it's not a frivolous question, then the committee would begin its deliberations on the issue. As I said, the participation in the committee is intended to be the participation in the committee is intended to the committee is designed to ensure that all of the members really participate actively in the committee, and so we require that each member of the committee vote in all of the votes that are held by the committee, with only a single absence per year being permitted. And so to the extent that DC members are not really participating actively in the committee, then they will be removed and replaced by other institutions in the market who want to take a more active role in the committee. The resolutions of the committee are binding on any parties to transactions that have incorporated the supplement. And the committee will determine matters such as whether a credit event has occurred, whether or not to hold an auction, whether a succession event has occurred, what would be an appropriate substitute reference obligation in circumstances where a common reference obligation has redeemed or disappeared, and then there's a general catch-all that will allow the committee to determine other relevant issues that are pertinent to the CDS market as a whole. We include that catch-all because we want to ensure that the committee is not constricted because we may not have thought of something that it would be appropriate for them to consider. Now, as part of the transparency of the committee's determinations, we require that the committee achieve a resolution on issues based upon a relatively high vote threshold. So in order for the committee to have resolved the matter, they need to have achieved an 80% supermajority. And to the extent that that 80% supermajority is not achieved, then the question that the committee is considering will be referred to a panel of external reviewers. Those external reviewers, again, in order to enhance the transparency, will be any kind of expert in the field of credit derivatives that any ISDA member will have requested be nominated into the pool. So we'll have a wide pool of potential candidates to serve on the external review panel, and then each time that a question gets referred to external review, the committee will select three members from that panel, and to the extent that the committee is unable to select those panel members in a unanimous fashion, then ISDA would fill up the remaining slots by selecting members from that pool at random. Obviously, those external review the external reviewers are going to be held to standards such as disclosing conflicts of interest, etc., just to ensure that the external review process is seen as a fair and unbiased system. So to the extent that a question gets referred to external review, then the proponents of the different arguments surrounding the question will have an opportunity to actually send in arguments to the external reviewers so that they understand the importance of the arguments and the different arguments that exist surrounding the question. And the external reviewers will be making their considerations or reaching their conclusions based upon the same information that was available to the committee. But to the extent that the external reviewers become aware through the external review process of additional information, they will inform the relevant committee of that additional information, and the committee at that time can decide to take the question back and actually resolve the issue in order to speed up the process. It's very important that this process, that the information that comes out of this process is disseminated quickly to the market, and so during deliberations, to the extent that conclusions have not been reached, the deliberations of the members of the committee will be confidential. But as soon as any conclusions have been reached, then ISDA will publish in real time that information on its website to ensure that the information is disseminated to the market as quickly as possible. The rules contain provisions for being updated from time to time. Obviously, this process is a new process, and so while we hope that we've thought of everything, then as the rules apply in practice, there may be additional things that we will want to address in the rules. And any contracting party that has entered into a transaction that incorporates the supplement will be deemed to have waived any claims against the members of the relevant committee. These members are really doing a service to the CDS market as a whole, and we don't want to hold them liable in relation to individual disputes between two parties to a contract. So that's really a kind of quick overview of how the committee works and what the purpose of the committee is. As I said, the supplement also includes a set of a form of auction settlement terms. But that form of auction settlement terms should be very familiar to you because it's based very closely on the auction methodology that is set out in the current CDS protocols that we have used over the past couple of years to settle credit events. So what I don't plan to do is really go into any detail on the auction methodology, and I'm going to jump forward in the slides to the slide that relates to the provisions seeking to achieve fungibility. This slide really relates to the third goal of the supplement, which is to achieve this 60-day or 90-day look-back period with respect to credit events and succession events. And the purpose of these provisions is to assist with achieving fungibility of transactions that otherwise have identical terms. So under the current system, with respect to credit events, I could enter into a transaction today with a 5-year maturity and then decide to enter into an offsetting transaction to the transaction that I enter into today in a year's time with an identical maturity date and all other terms of that transaction being identical, so the same reference entity, the same credit events applicable, and the same scheduled termination date. But because I would have entered into that transaction a year later, there may have been events that occur in the interim between those two transactions being entered into that would be valid credit events for purposes of the first transaction that I'd entered into, but would not be triggerable credit events for the second transaction because those events occurred prior to the effective date of that second transaction. If I was seeking to compress those transactions, then one party upon the compression of those transactions would essentially lose the value of those events that occurred with respect to the initial transaction. And so what we want to ensure is that any transaction that has the same scheduled termination date and that references the same terms are truly fungible in terms of the credit profile. And so we have instituted a change to the definition such that rather than permitting any credit event that occurs between the effective date and the scheduled termination date to be a credit event that will be triggerable, instead we require that the particular event must have occurred within the 60 calendar days prior to the date that the committee is asked to consider whether or not the event is a credit event or not. And so what we anticipate is that this will promote credit events being perhaps information about credit events being more readily available because the committee will be provided with notice of credit events that have occurred. And as I said, to the extent that those events occur more than 60 days before the committee was asked to consider the issue, then that credit event will become stale and would not actually be a triggerable credit event for purposes of a credit derivative transaction. We've applied a slightly longer period, but the concept is the same for purposes of succession events, simply because information about succession events sometimes takes a little bit longer to actually come out into the market. And we implement these changes via an amendment to the definition of the event determination date and via new concepts of the credit event backstop date and succession event backstop date in the supplement. So to the extent that you look at the new versions of the documents that were circulated this morning by ISDA, that is where you would find those provisions. Finally, so turning away from the supplement, which applies to new transactions, ISDA is, as I mentioned, going to publish a Big Bang protocol that will incorporate the supplement into the terms of existing transactions. It is intended that the protocol will have a very wide application, so we have a very broad definition of what would be a covered transaction for purposes of the protocol. The changes that the protocol seeks to achieve will be effective from April 8th, subject to two small caveats. The protocol can be incorporated, the protocol can have application to transactions where parties have specifically excluded that they do not want settlement to occur in accordance with the auction or an auction that ISDA might hold, in which case the protocol will still have application to those transactions for purposes of the determinations of the credit derivatives committees and for purposes of the 60-90-day look-back provisions. It's just that the settlement method would not be amended in those transactions. The second caveat to the April 8th implementation date is that the provisions relating to the 60 and 90 day look back are going to be effective from June 20th in order to avoid any concerns that the parties to an existing transaction have suddenly had their risk period or the risk profile on their transaction extended. The protocol achieves not only the implementation of the supplement into existing transactions, however, it also seeks to implement those transactions into new transactions that are entered into after the protocol is published, but that are documented on the basis of market standard documentation. Over the past number of years, ISDA has developed a large body of market standard confirmations for confirming a variety of different types of credit derivative transactions. And given the time table that we are working on, it just isn't possible at this stage to update and republish all of those market standard documentation. Those documents are also used within the DTCC system, and it's intended that over the coming weeks and months we will be republishing those templates. But in the meantime, if you enter into a, for example, a CDX trade based upon the market standard CDX documentation that ISDA publishes with markets, then the new transaction that you entered into will also be deemed to have been amended by operation of you having adhered to the protocol. The last thing that the protocol also does is that it will also achieve these amendments for purposes of novated transactions between to the extent that a transaction was initially in existence between one adhering party and a non-adhering party. To the extent that that non-adhering party transfers its position to a third party who is in fact an adhering party, then at that point the terms of that transaction will be converted to the new landscape, and that transaction will be deemed to have been amended so that it works on the basis of applying the changes that are implemented by the supplement. So in order to be a covered transaction, you have to have adhered to the protocol prior to the cutoff date, and for legacy trades, those trades actually have to be in existence prior to the cutoff date, so they need to have been traded, and they shouldn't have been terminated prior to the cutoff date. The last thing really to mention is just how do you adhere to the protocol. In the same way as other protocols that ISDA has published in the past, it's a very simple process of sending in a single adherence letter per organization or per legal entity. the ISDA is setting up a special email address that those adherence letters can be sent to. The adherence to the protocol is free. There's no charge for the service that ISDA is providing. And a new version of the protocol was published today on ISDA's website, so you can see in closer detail the changes that the protocol seeks to achieve. As David mentioned at the top of the call, adherence is going to be open on March 12th and will be closed on April 7th. So you need to get your adherence letters in by April 7th. And then the changes pertaining to the determinations committee and auction settlement will take immediate effect on April 8th. And the look-back provisions will take effect from June 20th. So I recognize that that is a lot of information that we've covered, but I'm going to turn back now to David Gein, and we can discuss any questions that people have.
Thanks very much, David. That's extremely helpful, very clear presentation. Thank you for that. There is a lot of information in that, as David mentioned, and people may take some time to digest it. But if there is, we will open the lines up now for questions, we'll take any questions that people have. If we need to clarify anything, or if there's anything we didn't cover in that presentation. So, operator, if you'd like to open up the lines, tell people how they can ask a question.
I will indeed, Mr. Gein. Thank you, sir. Please press *1 on your telephone if you wish to ask a question or to make a comment from the conference. There'll be a brief pause whilst we compile the Q&A roster, and then as soon as I have a name for you, Mr. Gein, I'll open that person's line.
Thank you.
Please stand by just a moment, sir. Ms. Torres, would you please press *1 again, and I'll open your line to ask a question. Thank you, ma'am. So your first question comes from Angela Torres. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Yes, I have a question regarding Section 2.9. In the previous draft, it was modified, but in the last draft, they changed the modification. Does that mean that the initial fixed rate payer calculation period will run from the effective date, or we will have a full period?
I'm happy to answer that, and I'll let the business people from the different institutions kind of jump in. In the very first draft of the supplement that we circulated, we sought to implement an additional change that the market is looking to, which is the full first coupon. From the feedback that we got, it was decided that rather than hardwire that into the supplement and so have that apply across the board and across geographical location, we would remove that from the supplement itself. So for purposes of the first fixed rate payer calculation period in the definition remains unamended. And so to the extent that trading conventions that evolve over time and people want to move towards a full first coupon, they would make that change in the individual confirmation to the relevant products that should apply to. So in the same way as currently the index products already make that change, the templates for those mm-hmm. types of products would be updated potentially via DTCC or in the actual paper conference.
But for the new trade conventions, then it has been saying that we will have for North American trade to trade full period, to have full periods. That's still supply?
That's the plan. But it's just not, it's just how you implement that, and doing it in the protocols is not really the structurally the best way, so. In the supplement, I should say.
Yeah, it's not amended in the supplement, but in market convention, it will apply for North American trades from the 8th April?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
For 100, 500, so for the standard trade, yes.
Yeah, thanks. And I have another question, if I can ask it.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, it regarding the master standard documentation, when you say that it's deemed amended until January 1st, 2011, that means that we don't have to change confirmations by now.
Yes, that's right. So the purpose of the protocol is to, the protocol will actually amend existing master confirmations so that those master confirmations work appropriately with the new regime. But the protocol will also prospectively amend the documentation that you use in the future up to January 1st, 2011 to document transactions to the extent that you use those market standard templates that ISTA and others have made available to the market. But what we anticipate is that prior to 2011, we will have new templates published, and to the extent that those templates get published, people will move over and start documenting their transactions on those new templates.
Thank you.
Thank you. And would all the people who have given their names please press star 1 on their telephone, and I'll open the lines one by one to ask questions. Please press star 1. Your first question comes from, is it Yetta Awika? Please ask your question.
My question is around switching from the existing trades we have on our portfolios to the new standards. Will there have to be bilateral agreements among counterparties for this to happen?
No, I mean, the purpose of the protocol is to actually achieve that. So what you would need to achieve that is that your institution would need to adhere to the protocol, and your counterparty would also need to adhere to the protocol. To the extent that your counterparty doesn't adhere to the protocol, then your transaction with that counterparty is not going to be covered by the protocol, and so the changes wouldn't be made. You could then subsequently agree on a bilateral basis with each of those individual counterparties that haven't adhered to the protocol to make those changes for purposes of transactions with those counterparties. But the idea is that the protocol will affect that, and it's an operationally efficient way to achieve that, because everyone can just send in one letter to ISDA, and then they're deemed to have amended all transactions that are covered by the protocol that they have in place with any other party that has adhered to the protocol.
I'm sorry, I'm a bit confused. I was under the impression that the protocol covers only trades from 320 onwards. So are you saying it covers all our existing trades?
Yes, that's correct.
In terms of recouping, in terms of moving to the standard coupons, that's what
I think this is Thanasis Tiflas from Deutsche Bank. I mean, the protocol we're describing is introducing the changes, the hardwiring of the credit event auction settlement method, and the effective date changes
correct
to your existing trades, not changing existing trades and recouping them to the new 100-500 standard.
Right.
That is not going to take place as via this protocol.
So the question is, what do you need to implement the new trading standard, meaning 100, 500, and full first coupon? The answer is you don't need a bilateral agreement to do that.
Okay.
It simply, you know, it will become the standard trade convention. It doesn't mean you can't trade off that, but that will be the standard when prices go out. And then when the trade is confirmed, those parts of it will be confirmed that way.
Okay.
So, for example, in DTCC, in that DTCC confirmation, when you use that standard trade type, it will deal with confirming that there's a full first coupon on the trade.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much indeed. And your next question comes from Thomas Dome. Please ask your question, sir.
Good evening. I've got actually two questions. The first one, in the Big Bang Protocol, basically you refer to the term governing is the master agreement. We and probably many of the other European and German banks or companies do have do use local master agreements, like, for example, the German master agreement. However, basically all the transactions are documented on the basis of the published ISTA docs or the market docs. We just want to make sure that basically all our transactions with other companies with whom we do not have an ISTA master agreement, but, for example, the German master agreement in place, are also covered. Therefore, we would appreciate a more wider definition. For example, instead of using governing ISTA master agreement, the usage of governing master agreement would be preferred, and then basically defining any ISTA master agreement or other master agreement that is in place, something like that. Could this be arranged?
Hello, this is Shruti from Allen Overy London. That is actually what has happened. So in the latest draft of the protocol, you'll see that that change has been made.
Oh, great, because I was reading the draft from the 22nd of February. Okay, great. Okay. And just a second question, in respect of the term excluded transaction, also from the Big Bang Protocol. Basically, excluded transaction, the fourth point was, means a bespoke transaction that refers to a portfolio of reference entity that is also substantially identical to the relevant portfolio for any series of credit-linked notes and so on. The problem for us, I would like to know basically all the transactions which are which do fall under this term, but basically, how can I know it? Because I mean, if later on a credit event occurs and the counterparty tells me, well, this bespoke transaction related to a credit link node, then all of a sudden it's not under under the terms of this this auction supplement. So basically, I think I know that this terminology has been used for various credit event protocols in the past. But it would be kind of like better than if there would be an excluded transaction, but this should be somewhere identified between on a bilateral agreement between the parties instead of making that general statement.
I mean, the purpose of that language is obviously if you have entered into a an OTC derivative as a hedge to a credit-linked node, then you wouldn't want to change the terms of that hedge because the protocol doesn't seek to amend the terms of the credit link node. In order to change the terms of the node, you would need to get node holder consent, etc. So so we need to ensure that any hedges to credit link nodes are also excluded. As you say, we have used this phraseology in the past, and while I appreciate that in theory it is a, you know, you could end up with a concern, I think the way that you would probably resolve that would be by you know, discussing with your counterparty on a bilateral basis to ensure that anything that they subsequently tell you falls outside of the protocol. They also provide relevant, you know, evidence that it is in fact a hedge to a CLM. And I don't think really addressing anything in the protocol itself would be more efficient, because as you mentioned, the alternative is, in any event, discussions on a bilateral basis with your counterparty. So I think our preference would be to retain the language as it is. It doesn't seem to have generated too much confusion or problems in the past. But to the extent that you need to clarify something with your counterparty, then you're obviously able to do that.
But when do you think would be the best way? I mean, we have also some credit link notes and some hedge positions there. I mean, would you suggest to do this already right now, just to tell the counterparty we've got this and this and this transactions, which basically are hedge transactions, and that they should be excluded from the protocol, or should this be done basically when a credit event occurred? What would be the right approach?
I mean, I see no harm in you given that this protocol has wider application than just the auction, the application of the auction, I see no harm in you discussing that with your counterparties now, just to make sure that you're both in agreement that, that a particular transaction is not going to be covered by the protocol.
Okay, but this exception solely relates to bespoke baskets. It does not relate to, for example, if I've got a node on an index, and I have a hedge on that index, which in both cases I would like to settle, for example, cash or physical, but not the standard way. So it's solely for bespokes.
Well, I think what we can definitely take this comment away and discuss this offline with you. I think then we'd want to have a look at the detail of the definition of bespoke portfolio transaction, just to see whether we feel that would be broad enough to cover some of the index baskets.
That would be great. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Now your next question comes from Barbara Voucher. Please ask your question, ma'am.
Yes, hello. Barbara Boucher from the National Bank of Canada. We've been talking to some participants here on the Canadian side and going through the changes that are being proposed. And though we do abide by the fact that putting in place a structure, giving more standardized turns on the market is a good initiative, we still have very major concerns with some of the changes. And we're still debating or reviewing the documentations in light of the broad powers given to the committee. We understand that initially the idea was to get less ambiguity on the market for some issues. Well, as now what we did is we created a committee and we basically give that committee full power to make any determination that they deem necessary, and it doesn't remove that ambiguity at all. If anything, because the decision of the committee are binding, it just creates another organ that's not necessarily representing the market participants, and the decision they can take, like changing the protocol, addressing the quorum issues, even the auction-specific terms are still elements that we consider as to being critical and we could determine often. So we still have issues on that, and we're trying to get a consensus and probably will submit more formally specific issues to that regard to the ISDA members. We've seen, however, for example, we've noted some particularities, whereas, for example, in section 9.1c3 of the supplement, they were stating that the committee's decisions were binding in respective of whether Shaw's determination is made by reference to any provision of the definition. We've seen that in the new version that you're circulating, you've changed that part. So we'll have to see if we still have the issue with that. We also saw later on that there is no obligation for the committee to ensure the accuracy or the veracity of the information on which it bases its decision, and we're a little bit ticked by that sentence, and so on and so forth. We also had some issue with the auction methodology, and that's a direct question we want to submit. During the Fannie Mae and the Freddie Mac auctions, there were some issues, a very critical point that were addressed at this at that auction, mainly the ability to, in the general sense of the credit market being able to deliver security senior obligation into the subordinate transaction. And in the Fannie Mae Freddie Mac situation, you had the auction, the subordinate auction recovery rate being higher than the senior. And at that point, there was question raised as to why could seniors, owner of protection, could not settle with subordinate recovery rate price. And I think at no point that issue has been addressed, and we were wondering why.
Let me step in here. This is David Keane from ISDA, and I'm sure some of the other speakers on the conference would like to add. comments to this, but just you said, Barbara, that you'd be sending in comments, and we look forward to receiving specific comments when you send them in, and we'll obviously address them in the same way we address all other comments and take account of them. I think in terms of your comments on the committee, the intention is that the committee will provide certainty and consistency across the market, and we've done as much as we can really to make the process, as David outlined in the presentation, transparent and robust and fair. And I think if you review the provisions, you'll see that that's the case. It is representative of both dealers and buy side, and we've really striven to make that the case. So I think it will, and the view that we take and that our working groups have taken is that this will increase certainty in the marketplace. I think you had some specific points, and we'll wait to get your comments on those. Just on the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac situation, we did, I think, and we discussed this in detail at the time, and I think the view that most people took was that what happened there with the senior and sub-auctions was something that was very specific to those particular entities and is not something that would generally be repeated. We did consider whether any changes would be necessary to make that, to make sure that situation didn't happen again. We considered it in the Icelandic auctions, for example, that happened sometime after that. And we kind of, having thought through different possibilities, felt that it wasn't, in the end, wasn't necessary. And therefore, we didn't implement that. And it was thought about again in the hardwiring process and was felt not to be necessary. Tom or Thanasis, I don't know if you want to add anything.
No, I mean, on the Fannie Freddie situation, it's important to understand that the two auctions were dealing with two separate liquidity events, i.e. trying to settle a very different number of bonds between the senior and the sub. I mean, in both senior auctions, there was very small kind of demand for liquidity in terms of bonds that were needed, as opposed to the sub auctions, where it was, you know, larger by, you know, factor of 10. So the fact that they ended up with different prices is not surprising. Actually, senior bonds were eligible for a settlement of the sub, but obviously not vice versa. So I do agree with your statement, of course, that was a very special situation given the kind of idiosyncrasies of the Fannie Freddie situation, and we haven't faced that problem, obviously, in any of the following auctions.
Sorry, just to make sure, the owners of senior transactions were not allowed to use the subordinate recovery rate.
No, they did not use the rate. They could deliver securities to the sub.
Yes, that's our understanding. And we still have some concern about the rationale in removing the restructuring event in the transactions covered by the Big Bang and the ability to confirm transactions that are not covered by the bid ban on DTCC.
Just to be clear, that restructuring is not being removed by the Big Bang, so existing trades were not impacted.
Yes, exactly, and not having them confirmed on DTCC.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand that, because those are existing trades that have already been confirmed in DTCC.
For future transaction, I mean.
There's no prohibition confirming trades with restructuring on DTCC. What Tom and Vanessa was talking about is the new market standard for North American corporates will trade no restructuring, but you can trade with restructuring. It just won't be a standard North American corporate trade.
So the standard North American corporate is just a trade type that has a lot of fields already defaulted to certain choices in that. But it doesn't mean you can't trade not using that. And you can confirm the DTCC as well.
Okay. That was not our initial understanding, but we can revert back to the documentation and still address that point with...
I just want to be clear that that's not really addressed by the supplement and the protocol.
Yes. Because when we looked at the documentation, we did notice that you're producing some long-form confirmations, and our understanding was that if we're not according to this new CDS contract,
then DTCC will reject your trade, and then you have to go paper.
At least that is what was circulated. When you have, in one of the documents that ISDA circulated, they were going over the operational way of dealing with those new changes, and this is where
But can we just be clear about which changes we're talking about? So there's one set of changes that's in the supplement, and by the protocol is being used to incorporate into the existing portfolio, and
exactly.
Then
and the other ones are not directly addressed by the protocol, but are still issues that are coming from the new change in the trading of the transaction itself.
I don't think there's anything. Just to address that last point, a revised draft of the ISDA credit derivatives physical settlement matrix has been circulated to the operations group. That includes the new standard North American corporate as an additional transaction type, but the existing North American corporate isn't being removed. The long-form confirmation is being produced to assist parties if they need to use a paper confirmation for any reason. But I think the reference you made to trades being rejected, I think that's only where you're using the new standard North American corporate and you don't submit one of the new terms correctly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. And your next question comes from Lisa Conrad. Please ask your question, ma'am.
My question is relates to the committee and requests that are submitted to the committee to determine succession and credit events. Since there's the 60-day and 90-day rolling period, if a request is in the committee, does that period toll while it's in the committee so that way it doesn't expire because it's been sitting in the committee and then the committee doesn't make a determination on the merits?
Yes, I mean, if you bring up the request, 59 days after the event and the committee takes another 2 weeks to decide, you don't lose your credit event, basically.
Okay.
So
and
the timing is basically off of when it gets raised to the secretary, which is ISDA.
Okay, that's helpful. And for events, particularly succession events that may have not been called as of yet but are currently kind of in the queue, but before the protocol has been signed, what happens to those?
So that's what we have this hardening period for in the protocol. So during those 90 days, up until the 20th of June, parties will be free to put in succession event request notices to the DC, and hence crystallizing their ability to call a succession event in respect of something which has happened more than 60 days prior thereto.
Okay. So
you have a concern that a succession event has happened, but you're not sure necessarily of the outcome, or you're not sure the address has been updated.
No action has been taken.
But if no action has been taken, then during up until June the 20th, the party will have the right to put in a notice to ISDA to request that a succession event request date occur, and that effectively will stop the clock running.
Okay. Okay, so we should switch from DTCC to the committee. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. And your next question comes from Victoria Maiman. Please ask your question, ma'am.
Hello? Yes. I'm seeking for clarification for the definition of North American corporate. A couple of words on that. Historically, back in November, December, we had an assumption that it may be a finite list of entities, as it was of reference entities, as we had a list provided from market partners with a proposal that those entities are going to be North American corporate for the new convention to go live in March. Later on, I think the thinking has changed to say that it's going to be just rule-based approach that whatever entity is tradable as North American corporate should be in scope. First of all, I was looking for confirmation if that's how it's going to be done. And second of all, if no red entities or entities which don't have that currently assigned are going to be included in scope for going live. Thank you.
Just to clarify, is the question then whether all North American corporates can trade on the new standard?
Right.
I think that is the case. I don't know if Tom or Thanasis, you have any different views?
No, that's the expectation.
Yeah, no, that's the expectation is you any trade that you're confirming on that standard. So.
Okay. Okay, and the entities are. North American corporates which don't have yet Red ID assigned via market partners processing, they include it as well, right?
Yeah. Todd, are you on? Todd Sullivan?
Yeah, that is the expectation. We can go back to the ops group specifically, but there's no reason that says we cannot, although we would obviously look to have market quickly scrub any entity that doesn't have an ID. But yeah, there's nothing that specifically prohibits you because the red has not been scrubbed yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
And your next question comes from Peter Hansen. Please ask your question, sir.
Well, thank you. Obviously, I have two questions. First of all, I would like to know, in the protocol, how do I carve out certain transactions? Reading the definition of party-specified excluded transactions, it tells me that I would specify such transaction in a particular transaction I'm entering into. But, I mean, if I haven't done so in my existing transactions, how could that apply? So I'm a bit puzzled about the said definition. How would I actually be able to carve out the protocol for certain transactions which I don't want to have covered under the protocol? I mean, it's a bit in line with one of the first speakers who was referring to the credit-linked node hedges.
I'm happy to address that. You can't actually carve out individual transactions from the scope of the protocol. The purpose of that definition that you're looking at, and we're seeking ways to make this clearer so that when people read it, they aren't confused by that. The purpose of that definition is really simply for future transactions that we are deeming to be amended. So future transactions that you've entered into on the basis of market standard documentation that we're deeming to be amended on the day that you enter into the protocol. So the day you enter into the protocol, you agree that any future transactions done on market standard documentation will incorporate the amendments from the protocol. Obviously, because you're agreeing that ahead of time, we want to still permit people at the actual time that they enter into the transaction to reverse that prior agreement. So that is really the only purpose of that that definition.
So Section 4F would only be applicable until January 1st, 2011?
I think that's actually a different definition, which we've changed in the current draft, you'll see, but that allows parties to agree bilaterally to exclude transactions in whole from the protocol. And you could enter into the side left with your counterparty, listing certain credit derivatives transactions and saying that you wouldn't want the protocol to apply to them.
So there's a provision in the latest draft?
Yeah, you'll see that we've changed it slightly.
Oh, okay, I see. My second question is rather a question in line with the market conventions to be changed. Has been addressed by members that this has an impact on hedges carried out in relation to seek capital relief? because obviously some of the regulators, and I'm speaking of the German regulators, have hardwired the credit events into the requirements for the CDS transactions to be considered for risk transfers in that relation. And restructuring is one of the three credit events they require in such transactions. So obviously, if the market convention for North American corporates would change in that respect, that restructuring is no longer a credit event, I mean, it's already in the law, in the regulatory law. I mean, is there anything going on to kind of lobby the regulators to tell them that this is no longer the case?
Peter, lobbying is certainly going on with regulators in relation to restructuring, although that we can't pretend that would be a fast process, but it's underway and it's been underway for a while.
Okay, so the issue has been addressed.
Well, it's being addressed at the Basel level.
Okay.
The issue has not been resolved. I mean, yes, the issue has been brought up to regulators, and they're aware, and they're also aware of the reasons that we chose to actually eliminate restructuring, which had to do with the risk, with the settlement risk, and also the fact that in North America, you know, we don't have a lot of restructuring credit events, given that there are ways in the bankruptcy code to actually facilitate an efficient restructuring of a company, but. Yes, we need to, as David said, we need to more work at the Basel level to actually address your concerns, which we do share.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You now have a question from Jane Bush. Please ask your question, ma'am.
Hi. My question's around the Determinations Committee and its role in relation to restructuring credit events. Is it intended that the Determinations Committee will be addressing all credit events, including restructuring credit events?
Yes, it's intended that the committee can determine whether or not a restructuring credit event has occurred, but the committee does not have the authority to actually decide to hold an auction with respect to a restructuring credit event under the current draft of the rules.
So it has no authority, yes, because I sort of see that you've changed the draft. I haven't quite caught up with that. So is this, there's no authority to hold, to resolve an auction?
Well, if there is a reference entity that has actually, you know, either a small number of bonds or a number of bonds that can facilitate an auction, the current thinking is that we will have to proceed with the protocol the same way as we have done till now. We will address probably restructuring more formally in the future, but there are more things that we need to work out in the meantime that, within the current time frame, we were not able to address. So it is more efficient to actually make sure that we deal with the bankruptcy failure to pay properly given at this round, and we will address restructuring later.
Understood.
So we have one final question, and my colleague is just getting the name of that party for you. Thank you, sir. Your next question comes from Lou Whitmore. Please ask your question.
Sorry to kind of harp on about the definition of excluded transactions, but my concern is that there's obviously a lot of institutions in the market who have done unfunded portfolio swaps for regulatory capital reasons, where there's a portfolio of reference obligations rather than reference entities which isn't linked to a market issuance or credit link note. I mean, obviously they wouldn't want the provisions of those transactions amended by signing up to the protocol.
And are you saying those are reference ob only deliverables?
Well, they wouldn't. Yes, I mean they wouldn't be deliverable. They'd be cash settled trades.
Well,
if the trade doesn't have the cheapest to deliver option that the standard trade has, then it's not subject to the auction.
Correct. Those trades.
So if you did a trade that linked to only one bond and that was the only thing that you valued, that trade is not covered.
And those trades were not covered in any of the protocols we have run till now.
Right.
Sorry, I don't quite follow that. I mean,
if you have a trade where there's only one potential reference ob, as opposed to a class of reference ob, you know, defined in the same way we define a deliverable obligation in a physically settled trade, if the only obligation is the reference ob that you can value in that auction for cash settling that, then that type of trade has not been covered to date by any of the auctions. And
No. I'm talking about a portfolio of several obligations. I mean, say there's a portfolio of 200 obligations, one of which is covered by the auctioning. I mean,
So you're talking about a portfolio trade where you have, let's call it, 100 reference entities.
No, reference obligations.
You have a trade with 100 different reference obligations from 100 different issuers, and if a credit event happens, all you do is value that single bond of that single issuer and nothing else, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, that is expressly not covered by the protocol, nor has it been covered by any of the prior ones.
And apologies, this is just lack of understanding of the docs. How does that get carved out?
Shruti, is that a definition of excluded non-auction transaction?
It's also in the, this is John Williams from Allen Overy, in the auction settlement terms, there are definitions of covered transactions. So there may be categories and the types of trades that you're describing would fall in this category. There are certain types of trades that are covered by the protocol in the sense that the terms of the supplement, like the role of the determinations committee and the 60 and 90 day look back provisions are applied to those trades. But they are not covered by an auction that the committee has the authority to create. And the reason for that is that they also have not been covered in prior auctions because the value proposition would be different from the standard trade. So in the type of trade you described, that would be covered by the protocol, the Big Bang protocol. But then when there's a credit event on one of the names in that trade, on one of the reference entities, the auction settlement terms that get published by the committee would exclude the definition.
That trade would be cash settled as previously agreed. If you have concerns about this, if you think that there are trades that you don't want covered that might inadvertently be covered, you can deal with that by simply going out to the counterparties on those trades and having it expressly excluded if there's concerns that you think gets picked up inadvertently.
But whether or not
your counterparty agrees to that is obviously up to them.
But I thought it was just said that you couldn't exclude individual transactions.
No, you can always bilaterally agree that notwithstanding the terms of the supplement, if you expressly reference it, that you can exclude it. You can always do that. The point about not excluding transactions was for existing transactions, absent bilaterally agreeing to exclude them, they will be covered unless they are expressly excluded.
Right, so you'd have to go to your counterparty and agree that outside of this protocol process.
But, the transaction you mentioned would not be subject to the auction as it's currently drafted. But if you wanted comfort, additional comfort, you could certainly bilaterally agree to that.
Sure. Okay, thanks.
Okay, operator, I think we're out of time.
Okay, Mr. Ginn, would you like me to close the Q&A session for you?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much, sir.
If people have other questions, they can send them to us to the address that was available there on the website, and we'll either address them individually or, if necessary, we can run another call to address people's questions. I'd like to remind people that the deadline for your comments on the documents that have been circulated today is noon New York time this Friday, the 6th of March. We will run more market education if necessary to make sure that as many people as possible understand this as well as possible. Please do check our website regularly for details. We now have a special section on the webpage which is accessible from the boxes on the left-hand side, where we will keep the latest drafts of the documents available, and we'll update people on calls. For those who are ISTA members and members of our various committees that have been receiving the updates and the memos on this, we will obviously continue to update members in that way as well. I'd like to thank David Lucking for his presentation today and for our other participants that answered the questions. I'd like to thank all of you for your questions and for your attention, and thank you very much.
With many thanks to all our speakers this evening, that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for participating, and you may all disconnect. Thank you, Mr. Gein.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.